This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
About comparative fault, the defense of comparative fault in contracts, let me start by presenting eight categories of cases to which I argue that the comparative defense should apply. Now, I'm going to do it very briefly, of course. Generally, the eight categories are sorted under two headings. The first heading is non-cooperation, and the second one is over-reliance. So let me start with non-cooperation. So these are, as I say, eight categories of cases to which I suggest that the comparative fault defense should apply. You could think of other categories, of course, but I think that this, that's my argument, should be the main categories. So the first category, failing to assist in performance, right? Cases in which a promisee failed to assist the promisor in performing the contract. The second one is failure to clarify misunderstandings, which are cases in which the you could think of a situation in which the promisor is going to breach or maybe just breach the contract, and it's because of some misunderstanding. He misunderstood legal rights and duties under the contract. The promisee could easily clarify the misunderstanding, but nevertheless fails to do so and induces, in a way, the breach of the contract. The third category, failure to provide information necessary to perform for performance. I mean, an example that they use is an example in which a contractor should do some construction work, and at some point of time, he or she encounters the geological difficulties which cause a delay in performance and the breach, and the promisee could have provided those information, the geological information to the other party, before the breach took place, and in this way to prevent the breach. So this is the third category, failure to provide information necessary to performance. The fourth category, failure to warn of a high potential loss. Right, so you could think of a situation in which the promisee has information about this high potential loss, and he fails to convey this information to the other party. If the promisor, the other party, had known about the high potential loss, he would not have breached the contract. And the argument is that the promisee was at fault by not providing this information to the other party. Again, don't confuse this category with Hedley and Baxendale with the foreseeability. So assume that the harm is still foreseeable. Right? I mean, take a simple example. Suppose harm could be from 10 to 1,000, and all the range is foreseeable under the Hedley and Baxendale. Right now, suppose that in the specific case, the harm is 1,000. So it is foreseeable under Hedley and Baxendale. Still, the promisor doesn't know whether it's 10 or 100 or 1,000. Just know that it's probably in the range of 10 to 1,000. The promisee could have provided the information to the other party that, in fact, it's going to be 1,000. Nevertheless, he failed to do so and induced a breach of a contract that would have been prevented if the promisor had all the relevant information. And the fifth category is creating apprehensions. Those are cases in which the promisor breached the contract because of, he thought that the other party would not perform. The promisee created apprehension in an unreasonable way, right? Created apprehension that he's not going to deliver his performance, and that's what led the promisor to breach the contract. Again, the promisee could have avoided the breach if he or she had eliminated those apprehensions at the right time. Now, so this is the non-cooperation category, so five categories. The second heading is cases of over-reliance. There are three categories under this heading. The first one is failure to restrain reliance in the face of a concrete risk of a breach. So you could imagine a situation in which the promisor, it's not an anticipatory breach, but still there is a substantial risk of a breach of the contract, say 50%. And the promisee could estimate that it's going that there is a risk, a substantial risk of a breach. Again, it's not anticipatory breach, so still there is no any duty under prevailing contract law, there is no any duty to mitigate. And nevertheless, the promisee relies, over-relies unreasonably, knowing that right under prevailing contract law is going to be fully compensated. So it's kind of a moral hazard, and the argument is that that could be also a type of contributory fault. The seventh category, failure to restrain reliance when there is no concrete risk of a breach. So as opposed to the first category, the sixth category, in which there is a concrete risk of a breach, on the seventh category, there is no any signs that the contract is going to be breached. Still, there is some positive probability that it could happen. Right? For example, I take somebody to guard my house in which I store valuable goods. Now, I don't have any reason to suspect that the other party would breach. Still, sometimes it would be unreasonable to completely trust the guard that he is going to perform the contract. Sometimes it would make sense for me to take additional precautionary measures. For example, it would make sense for me to activate the alarm system, for example, that is installed in the place, and not just completely rely on the performance of the promisor. The eighth one is relying on the mistaken belief that the contract has been adequately performed. So this is a case in which the contract has been breached. The promisee should suspect, as a reasonable person, should suspect that the contract was breached, but nevertheless it doesn't take any precautionary measures. So once again, the mitigation of damages probably would not apply, but still, as I said, it could be unreasonable from the promisee to rely on the contract, even though a reasonable person would understand that there is a substantial risk that in fact the contract has been breached. Okay, so these are the eight categories of cases, and let me now present to you in short the argument, right? I mean, the argument for comparative fault relating to those categories. So I'm going to ask two sub-questions about that. The first question would be, under what circumstances the parties would want to create either a duty or a burden on the promisee to cooperate or to avoid over-reliance? Right? That would be the first question. And my answer would be they would like to have a default rule. Right? Most parties would prefer to have a duty for the promisee, duty or full burden, to cooperate or to avoid over-reliance when the cooperation or the avoidance of over-reliance is of low cost. That would be my answer. In a minute, I will explain why. Okay, so that would be the first question, and the answer, as I said, would be when cooperation or avoidance of over-reliance is of low cost. The second sub-question would be, what should be the remedy that would allow the parties to achieve their primary goal, right? So if the answer to the first question is that the parties would like to have a duty or full burden or a burden on the promisee to cooperate or not to over-rely, the second question would be how that can be achieved, what should be the remedy, and my answer would be comparative fault, right? Not contributory negligence, no defense at all, but it would be comparative fault. So two questions, and let me start with the first one, which is the which is the question under what conditions the parties would like to have a burden or a duty on the promisee to cooperate. Now, I'm going to focus on cooperation, and I'm going to leave for the moment over-reliance, but it is applicable in exactly the same way. So it's in the paper, and if there would be questions, I would be happy to explain, but I'm going from now on to focus on cases of non-cooperation. So my argument is that when cooperation is low cost, then most parties would prefer to impose a duty or a burden on the promisee to cooperate. Now, why low cost? So let me go the other way and start with high cost. Suppose that cooperation is of high cost. Now, if cooperation is of high cost, there are several reasons for which the parties, well, many parties, would prefer not to have a duty or a burden of cooperation. Again, I don't say that there are not situations in which that what they want, but since we are talking about the default rule, we should, right, in order to have the default rule, we should be convinced that most parties would prefer such a rule to govern the contracts. So if cooperation is high cost, well, first of all, when cooperation is high cost, it's there are sometimes, well, or typically, there are many forms of possible cooperation. And it could be controversial. There could be disagreement between the parties whether they want to have a cooperation or not, what mode of cooperation that they would like to have. And I argue that it would be very hard to have a specific, you know, kind of a default rule that would be tailored, kind of a uniform default rule, say under those conditions there should be cooperation, and under other conditions there should be no cooperation. So when cooperation is high cost, because it could take different forms and different modes, it would be very hard to tailor a default rule that would be applicable to many parties. Now, the second point, which is related, is that when cooperation is of high cost, usually it's not for default rules, it's for the parties to regulate. Now, this is a kind of a positive but mainly normative argument. As a positive argument, we know, even though I know that there are enough exceptions for that, but usually default rules is not about the substance of the exchange. It's not about the, you know, it's usually the ancillary terms, the remedies, but not about the substance of the exchange. And, well, I know that there are exceptions, but as a normative matter, again, when it's about the substance of the exchange, it makes more sense to let the parties to regulate it the way they like and not to have a kind of a default rule for them. But the most important, the third point, the most important one, which I would like to focus on, is the asymmetric information and asymmetric control that the promissor has over the circumstances giving rise to the need to cooperate. Right, the reason that the promissee would be deterred to take upon himself a duty or a burden of cooperation, of high cost cooperation, is that he knows that he's going to be at the end of the other party. Well, first of all, the promissor knows better than him about the circumstances that would give rise to the need to cooperate. But more important, occasionally the promissor would have control over those circumstances. So it's a kind of a moral hazard problem on the promissor's side. Right? If I'm the promissor and I know that the promissee, under certain circumstances, would have a duty or a burden to cooperate, I would have incentives. Of course, usually I would do it in kind of unverifiable ways. I would have incentives to create those circumstances in order to save costs to myself. Now, the promissee knows that. And if cooperation is of high cost, it takes a very high risk. That's what I'm going to do. So his risk is that I, the promissor, will try to manipulate him, to exploit him, to maneuver things in a way that would create a duty or burden of cooperation. And that would be the reason why he would be reluctant to take upon himself such a duty or burden. So it's asymmetric information, but more importantly, asymmetric control over the circumstances giving rise to the duty or the burden of cooperation. And as I say, it would be exactly the same with over-reliance, but I'm going to focus on cooperation. Okay, now, exactly for those reasons, but from the opposite side, when it's low cost, it creates no such problems, right? So if it's low cost, cooperation. Maybe later I would say, in the paper I define what I mean by low cost. At the moment I would ignore it. So, but if it's low cost, then those reasons that I mentioned why the parties would not like to have high cost cooperation do not prevail. So exactly for those situations, we need default rules. the risk of asymmetric control, of asymmetric information is much less severe, because at the end, the policy says, well, it's low cost. So even if you try to manipulate and so on and so forth, it wouldn't cost me a lot. So policies would be more willing to accept upon themselves a duty or a burden of cooperation when it is low cost. Okay, so that's about the first question, the first sub-question. So my answer to the first question is, the parties would like to have a burden or duty of cooperation when it's low cost, especially when it's low probability, because if it's high probability, even without it, the parties probably would have good reason to try to regulate it. But if the probability of the need to cooperate is of low probability, then default rules are much more needed. But again, I don't see any reason why not to have, when it, as long as it's low cost, even with high probability, still there could be a good reason, you know, to save transaction costs, to have also a duty or burden of cooperation. But it's especially essential when it's low probability and high and low cost. So this is the answer to the first question. Now the second question is, what would be the remedy that would allow the parties to achieve their goals? So now we are talking about two parties that know that they would like to have the policy to cooperate or to avoid over reliance when it's low cost. And the question is how exactly they are going to give the right incentives to both parties, right? So what would be the remedy? And my answer is comparative fault. And here is the simple intuition. The intuition is the following. The parties want the policy to cooperate when it's low cost. Now, theoretically, they could put the entire burden on him if he fails to cooperate. And then he would have the right incentives to cooperate, right? But then, if that's what they do, what would happen if the promisee would fail and not cooperate? Would be negligent, you know, it happens, exactly as in thought, right? So it's quite possible, and we see from the case law, that there are many situations in which promisee do not cooperate. And then it could still be efficient for the promisor to perform. So it's a kind of a second best, right? So in an ideal world, if you put the entire burden on the promisee, he would cooperate and that's it. But since sometimes promisee would fail to cooperate, we still would like to have incentives for the promisor to perform nevertheless, even if the promisee failed. Now, it may remind some of you that, you know, in thoughts, when we had contributory negligence, contributory negligence, right, instead of comparative negligence in torts, there was the last opportunity doctrine. And the last opportunity doctrine was exactly about that, right? So the victim failed to take precautions. He was negligent. Still, we want the injurer still to take precautions. Even if the victim failed to take precautions, we still want sometimes the injurer to take precautions in order to reduce the losses. Now, exactly the same thing here. So what I assume here is, right, that we want the promisor to perform, we want the promisee to cooperate when cooperation is of low cost, but if the promisee does not cooperate, still, as long as performance is efficient, we want the promisor to perform. And for that reason, comparative fault would be better than any other rule which would place the entire burden on the promisee. So what I would suggest is the following. I would say that we want to have a burden on the promisee, the minimum burden necessary to provide him with the right incentives to cooperate when it's low cost, right? We want to put a burden on it. And it should be the minimal one necessary. I'll explain in a minute why it should be the minimal one necessary. So it should be like, we want the promisee to be exposed to a liability risk of cost plus, right? If a cooperation is $10, it would be enough that his liability threat would be $11, right? Doesn't need to have the entire burden on him in order to give him incentives to cooperate. Now, still by definition, right, we are talking now about low-cost cooperation. Typically, we wouldn't need too much of liability on the promisee in order to incentivize him to cooperate. So we need much less, typically, we would need much less than the entire harm to be placed upon him. We would need much less than that. That's one point. Now, if that's what we do, then the rest of the harm would be placed upon the promisor. And the promisor would have the incentives to perform, right? Sometimes he would not perform because he's not going to pay for the entire harm. So sometimes there would be inefficiencies. So there is a kind of a trade-off here, right? We want to improve the incentives of the promisee. Sometimes it would be at the expense of lesser incentives on the promisor, true. But as long as the burden put upon the promisee is as low as possible, as low as necessary to incentivize him to take precautions, enough would be left upon the promisor, so he would have incentives to perform, even though there would be some situations in which that would not happen. Now, why the parties would decide about a minimum burden? Why they would decide about a minimum? First of all, as I said, it would typically be enough in order to give incentives to promisee. Secondly, exactly for the same reason that the promisee would take upon himself only low-cost cooperation, right? He would not take upon himself, remember the first question, he would not take upon himself a high-cost cooperation because he doesn't want to be at the end of the promisor that can manipulate things, et cetera, right? Because of the asymmetric control and asymmetric information. Exactly for the same reason, the promisee would not be willing to take the risk that even though cooperation is low cost, he would fail and would have to bear a large burden of damages. So exactly for the same reason that there is asymmetric, right? The asymmetric information, the asymmetric control of the promisor over the circumstances which give rise to cooperation, the parties would limit the liability of the promisee to the minimum necessary to provide him with the incentives to cooperate. So there are two points here, right? The first one is that placing a relatively modest burden would typically be enough to give the right incentive to the promisee. Secondly, doing more than that would encounter a resistance of the promisee that would say, just a minute, even though it's a low-cost cooperation, I know that sometimes I may fail to cooperate, and since I know that you, the promisor, control the circumstances giving rise to the need of cooperation, I don't want to put myself at your hands. So even if it's a low cost, remember that sometimes low cost cooperation may end up with high costs of non-cooperation, right? Even though the cooperation is of low cost, sometimes I may fail, and then it could be very costly. As long as performance is efficient, we want the promisor to perform. And for that reason, comparative fault would be better than any other rule which would place the entire burden on the promisee. So what I would suggest is the following. I would say that we want to have a burden on the promisee, the minimum burden necessary to provide him with the right incentives to cooperate when it's low cost, right? We want to put a burden on it. And it should be the minimal one necessary. I'll explain in a minute why it should be the minimal one necessary. So it should be like, we want the promisee to be exposed to a liability risk of cost plus, right? If a cooperation is $10, it would be enough that his liability threat would be $11, right? He doesn't need to have the entire burden on him in order to give him incentives to cooperate. Now, still by definition, right, we are talking now about low-cost cooperation. Typically, we wouldn't need too much of liability on the promisee in order to incentivize him to cooperate. So we need much less, typically, we would need much less than the entire harm to be placed upon him. We would need much less than that. That's one point. Now, if that's what we do, then the rest of the harm would be placed upon the promisor. And the promisor would have the incentives to perform, right? Sometimes he would not perform because he's not going to pay for the entire amount. Sometimes there would be inefficiencies, so there is a kind of a trade-off here, right? We want to improve the incentives of the promisee. Sometimes it would be at the expense of lesser incentives on the promisor, true. But as long as the burden put upon the promisee is as low as possible, as low as necessary to incentivize him to take precautions, enough would be left upon the promisor, so he would have incentives to perform, even though there would be some situations in which that would not happen. Now, why the parties would decide about a minimum burden? Why they would decide about a minimum? First of all, as I say, it would be enough in order to give incentives to the promisee. Secondly, exactly for the same reason that the promisee would take upon himself only low-cost cooperation, right? He would not take upon himself, remember the first question, he would not take upon himself a high-cost cooperation because he doesn't want to be at the end of the promisor that can manipulate things, et cetera, right? Because of the asymmetric control and asymmetric information. Exactly for the same reason, the promisee would not be willing to take the risk that even though cooperation is low cost, he would fail and would have to bear a large burden of damages. So exactly for the same reason that there is asymmetric, right, the asymmetric, mainly the asymmetric information and the asymmetric control of the promisor over the circumstances which give rise to cooperation, the parties would limit the liability of the promisee to the minimum necessary to provide him with the incentives to cooperate. So there are two points here, right? The first one is that placing a relatively modest burden would typically be enough to give the right incentive to the promisee. Secondly, doing more than that would encounter a resistance of the promisee that would say, just a minute, even though it's a low-cost cooperation, I know that sometimes I may fail to cooperate, and since I know that you, the promisor, control the circumstances giving rise to the need of cooperation, I don't want to put myself at your hands. So even if it's a low cost, remember that sometimes low cost cooperation may end up with high costs of non-cooperation, right? Even though the cooperation is of low cost, sometimes I may fail, and then it could be very costly. So I would like to reduce it, knowing that the other party has a control over the circumstances that are giving rise to the duty or the burden to cooperate. So for those reasons, the parties would place the minimal burden, they would prefer to have a minimal burden in the promisee, and that's the comparative fault that I have in mind for those kind of cases. Okay, I think I'm talking for 20 minutes at least, so I would stop here and take questions. Yes, Richard.
Yeah, I'm curious as to why you want to go into the rubric of comparative fault, when it seems to me that this doctrine is pretty well handled by the idea of excusing conditions on the one hand and mitigation of damages on the other within the traditional framework. So if you take the example that you start to give on page 4 of this paper about the wrong instructions with respect to the way in which a project is to be completed, the general rule is not a binary one, at least under accepted current contract law. I give you confusing instructions, and that increases your cost by $10,000 if I do the best given those instructions. I recover the $10,000, but I'm certainly not allowed to say, oh, I got confusing instructions, I'm not going to do anything at all, and then come up with a $50,000 loss because the project languishes. So why can't we simply say that what happens is you get excused from performance in virtue of the defect of the other party, but the new duty that comes into place is to try to get back to the status quo ante, i.e. the correct sequence of performance as quickly as possible, and for those damages you're left indifferent, which means in effect that the cost of error comes out of the profits of the party who made it rather than the party who tried to comply. I mean, that seems to me to be what the answer is. So why is it that we call this a binary case when it doesn't seem to be a binary case?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say that your argument relates only to the first category.
That's what I'm most talking about.
Okay. So that's important, because even if you are right, still there are all the other categories.
Well, I think you can write by analogy, I think.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Because you see the different,
talking about number two category. You talked about misunderstanding.
Right.
Which is to say, I can't see the difference between it.
Okay, so it's even better for me to start with misunderstandings. Right, so there is misunderstanding, and each behavior, right, the promissor's behavior and the promissee's behavior, each of them is a but for cause for the entire world. Right, you see, in all those situations, the promissee contributed to the breach. He didn't directly contribute to his own losses. This is the other three categories of over-reliance. You see, the headings of cooperation and over-reliance is also the distinction, the causation is different here for both, right? So with those categories, the promissee contributed or induced the breach in a way, contributed to the breach of the contract, and indirectly contributed to his own losses. With the third other categories of over-reliance, the promissee did not affect the promissor's behavior at all. He just over-relied, so he directly contributed to his own losses. Now, so in those categories, in most of the categories, I'll relate to the first point, but see, if it's failure to clarify misunderstanding, and you have some misunderstanding about your duties and the rights under the contract, and you are going to breach the contract. Once you breach, I suffer X harm, X damages, right? Losses of X. Now, I can avoid the breach by telling you, Richard, you are wrong about your understanding of the contract. Right? Read section 2, and then you will understand that you should comply with the term. Now, in this case, you cannot, right? I mean, the harm is one. My behavior and your behavior both are a but-for cause for the entire harm. And that's the same with the other categories. Now, with the specific category of failing to assist in performance, of course, there would be situations in which you could separate between different items of the harm and say, you caused to item one, and I caused to item two. And then, of course, you would be right. By causation principles, each would be responsible, if at all, only for part of the harm. Now, with the example of the issuing confusing instructions, again, it depends on the circumstances. Sometimes you cannot make this operation. In case there are cases, American cases, going to both directions. Some would do exactly as you suggested. Usually it goes with liquidated damages. Suppose there are liquidated damages for each day of a delay, sometimes courts would say the promissee is responsible for delay of 10 days and the promissor for 15 days, and that would be a kind of an apportionment damages. But in other situations, you cannot do it. So maybe you are right, or you are right, that sometimes under category A, there would be apportionment under prevailing contract law by using causation principles. But sometimes it won't be the case. So the cases that are interest for me are those cases in which there is a harm and each party is a but-for cause for the entire harm.
Yeah, well, let me just clarify one little bit, which is I think that the way I would do this would be a complete decision tree instead of a partial one. What you've done, in effect, is you say breach number one, breach number two, all cases joint causation. What happens is the probability in most sort of cooperative construction contract situations, breach in stage one is followed by a rescue operation in stage two. At that point, mitigation becomes damages. So the point I'm saying is, whatever you want to do with the joint causation problem, allocation may be fine, but the real thing is you would rather have them go the corrective route. And if that, in fact, happens 90% of the time, you want to get the right damage rule there, which is, in fact, to cover the additional cost of mitigation. So I don't think you have all the steps in the decision.
No, but I completely disagree with you about mitigation, because mitigation does not apply to none of the eight categories that I described. Mitigation, right, the duty to mitigate applies only after there is a breach of the contract. Most treatises would even say after there is a known breach of the contract, but there should be a breach. Now, in all those examples, there is still no any breach of the contract, right? I behaved in a way that contributed to your breach. Courts would not apply a mitigation of damages defense to those cases. I don't know even a single case that courts would apply.
That you just gave where he
created grounds for insecurity. duties to pre-mitigate all sorts of things exist.
What?
Create grounds of insecurity before breach, you know.
That's the fifth category. But again, it's second. Okay, so that's the fifth category, and it's not mitigation, right? The 18th declaration under section 251 of the restatement, right? When one party creates a prohibition that he's not going to perform, the other party could ask for an adequate assurance, and if the first party would fail to provide adequate assurance, the second party could repudiate, right? Could treat the contract as it has been repudiated by the other party. But think of a case, and I have an example in the paper, right? Of a case in which the breaching party, even though had a right to ask for adequate assurance, that just didn't do it, right? Just didn't do it, but breached the contract. So one could say, well, so in that case, it should be his own problem. Another possibility, and there is some support in the case law to this solution, another possibility to say, well, there is a fault of the party that created the apprehension, and even though the other party was entitled to require adequate insurance, his failure to do so is not a reason to eliminate any remedy, right? So that's a category that I would say a comparative fault. Again, but it's not mitigation. Mitigation is only about cases in which there is a breach of the contract and then the behavior of the right, I mean, the other party fails to mitigate. So,
an observation, but focus on my question, so can I have the observation, not the observation? The observation is that I think we can always find situations where comparative fault seems very attractive, but we also know in the back of our minds that it can be very costly. That is, if I know I might be subject to comparative fault, I might take over precautions because I don't have faith that the fact finder will get it exactly right, or I don't know what the other party's going to do, or their chicken problems, and so forth. So with that in mind, my question is, what's your real goal here? If I look around the world of law, there are many, many areas where we could have opted for comparative negligence or comparative fault, but we opted more or less for a winner-take-all rule, or Calabresi might say at least cost-avoid rule or something. In all those cases, we can think of situations where, you know, maybe we can list a lot of categories and two-by-two charts, and we can say, oh, there are situations where maybe the other side could help. You really want to go for, I'll list a few of them, but you really want to go for a world where we impose those costs and those dangers of over-precaution, so we have to take your intuition over, you know, a couple thousand years of legal history. I mean, I'll just list some. So in virtually all legal systems, the law finders could be comparative fault. It's a winner-take-all system. In virtually all legal systems, the law of bailments is a winner-take-all system. The good faith purchaser of stolen property in all but one legal system picks one winner or the other and goes there. Maybe products liability, maybe security interests. You know, my home mortgage, more or less there's a winner, and very rarely will the court say the first mortgage or the second mortgage, oh, it's so complicated, who can, why don't they just divide it, you know, 80-20. Maybe even voting, you know, Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court could have said, oh, we don't really need a winner in the election. I mean, let's go with comparative fault. Yeah. You get 3.1 years, you get 0.9, you know. It's always subject to this kind of analysis. I mean, how do we know when to look for the weak cases?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's the same analysis. You see, it seems to be like the same problem, but I don't think it's the same analysis, right? I mean, if you want to take the argument of same analysis, I would respond, look at TOTS, right? In TOTS, we have all over the world, I know of no jurisdiction that did not adopt comparative fault, right? Probably if I presented a paper in the 60s, well, I was too young, but if I presented here a paper in the 60s in which I would argue for comparative fault in TOTS, Saul would say, well, we don't need such a
no,
thing.
No, 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 I accept that. So I say, so there's one area that went to comparative fault.
No, the only thing I would say, I would say, well, in other areas I don't know, when we should look at it carefully. Each field has its own goals that we want to achieve, etc., etc. Maybe sometimes it would work, sometimes it would not. So I limit myself to contracts only. I cannot respond to the question.
Although many items on my list are contracts, right? Home mortgages and bailments and...
Yeah, but with comparative fault, right. I mean, but I think some of your examples are cases in which nobody is at fault, which creates a different problem. It's created a different problem. I don't say that there is no some analogy between the two, but it's different. So what actually am I... Now, and remember one more thing. You see, it's not that I try to offer you something which is, you know, a kind of my own wild imagination. Right? In the rest of the world, well, in many jurisdictions, that's exactly what they do. In Europe, Fabrizio told me that in Italy, in a call from 1865, they have a comparative fault in both tolls and contracts. It's more than 200 years ago. So it's not such a kind of a, you know, imagination that makes no sense. So I'm trying to explain why. So generally, the idea is that sometimes, exactly as in tolls, you want also to leave some burden on the promisee because you want to give him incentives to behave in a way, right? Otherwise, he's under a moral hazard, you want to change it. And the question is, of course, where to put the lines.
And two questions about, you know, the strategy you have in arguing for this. One has to do with your argument that this is, you advocate something that doesn't exist. I think you could find many of these things, you know, kind of seeds in case law. As we said, creating apprehensions has to do with reasonable grounds for insecurity, and there are many provisions for this in the code, also in installment contracts. Right. Failure to clarify misunderstandings, Posner in Market Street, good faith obligation. Failure to warn of high potential loss, well, you distinguish it from Hadley, can make the argument that this is just right, you know, down the alley. You have to let the other party know what is your abnormal cost, even if you call it foreseeable, it's in the same family. So with not much work, this becomes a positive paper rather than, you know, advocating something that will turn contract law on its head. So that's one direction where I would think of, you know, presenting this a little differently. The other has to do with, I really can't follow, and I think we did an exchange on this early on, this high cost, low cost distinction. It's clear that, you know, if a corporation costs zero, it should be done. If it costs more than the value of the contract, it should not be done. So there must have been some cutoff point where it went from should be done to should not be done, and so it's a cutoff, it's a threshold case, it's not. Okay, you can call it high and low, but we usually, the strategy we employ is to say, to try to identify what this cutoff is. It's kind of a least cost avoider, or joint avoidance of harm model. That's what it is, and since you kind of invoke the tort analogy all along, just invoke it here too, and you say, you know, both parties face standards. I'm not sure what this whole low versus high terminology does beyond telling us that there is a cutoff.
Yeah. Well, your first point, Henri, there is a substantial difference between what you see in positive law and what I argue, and this is the comparative fault, not contributory, but comparative. So, apportionment of damages, and that's what you don't see, right? The cases that you mentioned, right? Creating apprehensions, this is not comparative fault. It's either all or nothing. And the same with the case that you mentioned of Dick Posner. Again, it's all or nothing. So if you didn't clarify misunderstanding, that means that now the promisee is going to bear the entire loss. And I'm against that. You see, I think that even if the promisee sometimes, right, failed to clarify, well, in the Posner's case, it was not just a failure to clarify misunderstanding, it was probably a deliberate avoiding of clarifying misunderstanding, so it was not negligent, it's different. But if it's negligent, a failure to clarify misunderstandings, I don't think that you should move from one party pay all to the other party pay all. I think that that's exactly the point. Comparative fault means that we don't want this binary solution of either one or the other, but sometimes what we want to have a kind of a trade-off, to have incentives for both parties and not just put everything on one party. And again, it is done in many other jurisdictions. So I could have given this paper in another country, and everybody would say, well, this is a positive paper, not a normative one. Here, it is considered to be a normative one. Right? So so that's my first point. Again, in the Hadley, and again, Hadley is, again, it's either everything is on one party or on the other. So if it's unforeseeable under the Hadley, the promisee is going to build the entire loss. Under my scheme, sometimes what we want to do is, because I failed to convey information to you and you breached the contract, that I would bill some of the losses and you would bill some of the losses. So the idea is to provide incentives to both, even though it's not perfect for each of them separately, but maybe that would be the optimal trade-off. Now, the second point, low and high. Well, I disagree that it's about, when you say, well, whether this is the right thing to do or not, right? We want somebody to take precautions or not. Because this is exactly the point. Because the promisee knows that the promisor has a control over the circumstances giving rise to the need cooperation, because the promisee knows that this is unverifiable on many occasions, he takes a huge risk if he agrees, you know, to a kind of a standard which says whenever cooperation is efficient, you should cooperate. I would not take it upon myself if I was promising. That's too much, right? Because I don't trust you. You may try to manipulate things, and then I would have to bear a huge burden, right? There is a moral hazard problem that promissor would create situations in which cooperation would be needed, and that's exactly what I want to avoid. So for that reason, I would take upon myself, I as the promissee would take upon myself such a burden only if I know that the risk is not high. Now, of course, it's a kind of a standout, and that's exactly the reason why I suggest categories. You see, this is something which I think quite important. I think that's what courts should do. It's not just a standard of comparative fault. I think that it should be, on one hand, a standard, but under that standard, courts should have a kind of set of default rules. So you could look at the eight categories as eight default rules, which says under what circumstances the promissee should cooperate or should avoid over-reliance, otherwise you would have to bear some of the losses. And Dick.
Yeah, let me, just two related questions on what you're asking courts to do here. One, in the paper you mentioned that you're assuming that all the relevant behaviors are verifiable. So the first question is just, would your conclusions change if that wasn't if some of it wasn't verifiable in court? Second question related, even if the court can verify everything the parties did and didn't do, does the court also have to decide what they should have done? And here's an example. Suppose you come up with a brand of beer, but I'm now marketing it, and I pay you a royalty on every can I sell, and it turns out maybe I'm not doing a real good job of marketing it, but maybe you were at fault in some ways too, so we're in a comparative fault regime. In order to apportion the comparative fault, does the court have to decide not just how much I was marketing the beer, but how much I should have been? Question.
Yeah. Well, again, I'll start with your second point. Of course, that exactly as under a negligence rule, of course, that there would be many questions what exactly is required for each party, and I don't think that the fact that I cannot maybe give kind of a direct answer what should be under a specific case, that exactly as with negligence. So it's kind of a standard, and the question would be, were there circumstances under which a low-cost cooperation would induce performance or would reduce dramatically the cost of the other party in performing the contract? So again, it's low-cost. It should be low-cost, that's what I argue. Of course, if the benefit of cooperation is higher, court's tendency to recognize the defense should be higher as well. So that would be my response to the second point. So the first point about verifiability, I didn't say, so it is true that I assumed that there is some verifiability, exactly as with negligence, right? If we don't have verifiability in torts, we would prefer strict liability. Exactly also in contracts, right? If there is no verifiability in the sense that court could not know what the parties could have done and so on and so forth, then a fault regime of any type would be useless. And then we won't, but this is the same as torts. I don't see any difference in this regard between torts and contracts.
Do you want to take one more question or wrap up?
Yeah, take more questions.
Okay. One more.
As you know, I'm very supportive in I'll try to provide some evidence tomorrow that our experiences where this is done. But if you could go back to your chart, one, saying a couple of things. One, in relation to what Richard was saying about the distinction between excuse and the causation. It seems to me that, correct me if I'm wrong, but here we're talking, the other one, perform, not perform. Here we're talking about fostering cooperation. Now, while I see that the causation might perform that function, does the excuse system perform the function of fostering cooperation on the promissee, or is it just a matter of risk allocation? Because it seems to me that it might make a difference if you're talking about risk allocation or fostering cooperation. The issue here, I think, that's my question, is that you said that when it comes to failure to cooperate on the part of the promissee, still you would ask the promissor to perform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at least in the systems I know, that wouldn't trigger comparative fault, because comparative fault only operates if the promissor breaches. So I think one of the issues concerning cooperation, which goes back to most of the comments that were made is that in order to foster cooperation, you might need to have two different rules. One that works when breach occurs, one that works when the promisee increases the cost of performance, but the promisor performs. If the promisor performs despite the fact the promisee is not cooperated, you need to have good faith or other rules that will charge the overcost of the promisee. If the promisor doesn't perform, you can use comparative fault. That's the way it works in Europe.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is also my suggestion. I don't say that if the promisor performed at the end, he would be able to collect something from the promisee. I don't argue for that.
So the comparative fault wouldn't work here?
No. So what I'm saying is that the comparative fault would give incentives for performance. Now, if the promisor at the end failed to perform, then there would be an apportionment of damages. If the promisor performed, then he would not be entitled to any compensation. That's my scheme.
Thank you, Ariel.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.